Great, thank you so much. I'd like to begin by acknowledging my co-authors, Dr. Phil Brown and Dr. Rachel Merlo-Frosch. And this research is supported by a grant from NSF. And we have no financial relationships to disclose. So my talk today is based on the question of how do people talk about using biomonitoring research in the case study of chemicals that are used as flame retardants in common household products. And we find that biomonitoring research seems to have profound implications for social movements, for health behavior, and for policymaking around chemical exposure. I'll start by giving an overview of biomonitoring and specifically related to flame retardant chemicals. And I'll present our methods and findings and talk about implications of our work. So we know that biomonitoring has been rapidly increasing as a type of scientific method. It's widely used by scientists, by the federal government, through the NHANES biomonitoring program. And environmental advocacy groups also conduct biomonitoring projects, what are commonly called advocacy biomonitoring projects, in which participants are encouraged to speak out about their body burdens in public forums. Thus, we can see that biomonitoring has become a tool for research, regulation, and activism. And we know that biomonitoring is important for public health. It lets us know about the impact of public health interventions. We can see here that biomonitoring lets us see the impact of removing lead from gasoline in a US-based population. And additionally, biomonitoring allows for the quantification of one step in the risk assessment model by empirically identifying an individual's own personal exposure. It's also useful for policy making. It allows regulators to identify chemicals of concern and has been cited in testimony by state-level legislators when it comes to banning specific types of chemicals. We also know that biomonitoring is important to industry. As this quote from their website shows, the American Chemistry Council supports what they call science-based biomonitoring, but they stress that biomonitoring is limited because it is unable to complete the exposure pathway from exposure source to disease outcome. Biomonitoring also raises many ethical questions, one of which relates to the report back of information that came up in the last presentation. Do participants in a study have a right to know their results, especially if those results might not be tied to specific interventions that they can use in their own lives? In many cases, our ability to detect is outpacing our ability to interpret the results. But many researchers do support reporting back all available information to participants. And related to breastfeeding, there is concern that women who have their cord blood, their breast milk tested might stop breastfeeding, but the existing research doesn't show that to be the case. And in fact, when there are open lines of communication and a trusting relationship between researchers and participants, there's strong evidence that women like to know their breast milk levels, and it doesn't influence them to stop breastfeeding. So now I'll talk specifically about flame retardant chemicals, which are widely used in consumer and household products, from computers to insulation in buildings to chairs. They're everywhere. They're all around us. Two common types of flame retardants that have been widely used in the U.S. are the polybrominated diphenyl ethers, the PBDEs, and also the TRIS formulations, which were widely used in children's pajamas in the 70s and are coming back in some household furnishings. And results from animal and laboratory studies suggest that exposure to some types of flame retardants may have serious health consequences, and we're starting to see early human health studies as well, which have found that PBDE exposure in particular is linked to reproductive disorders, behavioral outcomes, decreased IQ, autism spectrum disorders, decreased fertility, and differential hormone levels. The earliest influential studies of human exposure to PBDEs were done in Sweden, where they found this exponential increase over a 25, 30-year time frame in women's breast milk in Sweden. And since then, flame retardants have been found in every corner of the globe, from Tasmania to the Arctic, in all types of biological samples, and in virtually all people. In the U.S., most flame retardants, like chemicals in general, are only loosely regulated, and manufacturers do not have to demonstrate complete environmental or health safety before chemicals can be approved for market use. states have taken the lead in the last decade in banning several types of chemicals on a chemical-by-chemical basis. And at the national level, flame retardant chemicals could be regulated through the EPA or potentially through the Consumer Product Safety Commission. Internationally, there's been more activity. So Sweden banned PBDEs earlier than we did in the US. And the new European REACH law, which went into effect in 2007, has already identified several other types of flame retardants beyond the PBDEs for undergoing future risk assessment. And the issue of flame retardant chemicals has attracted a wide variety of organizing by social movement organizations, professional groups, and nonprofits. And this also includes some product manufacturers. So some companies like Dell and Apple have committed to phasing out the use of certain types of brominated flame retardants in their products. The research that I'll present today is part of an ongoing NSF-funded project, Flame Retardant Chemicals, Their Social Discovery as a Case Study for Emerging Contaminants. And the paper today draws on over 35 in-depth interviews with people who work in some way related to flame retardant chemicals, so activists, scientists, regulators, fire safety experts, and industry representatives. And additionally, the larger flame retardant project also covers topics such as risk and hazard perception, social movement decision making, and how flammability standards at state and national levels have been developed. So now I'll present our findings. Many respondents talked about biomonitoring as something that was compelling to the public or was central to their work, and they gave several reasons for this. First, biomonitoring provides scientific links between exposures and outcomes. So this public health scientist talks about measuring PBDEs and says, then you can tell a whole story about source to disease. Additionally, biomonitoring simplifies complex science so that it is understandable for the public. This environmental organizer says, I think there's a lot of people out there who still don't know that these chemicals get into their bodies. And through biomonitoring, we know that they, the chemicals, are. Respondents also emphasize that biomonitoring, when it is done in cord blood or breast milk, is particularly compelling. They said that it has scientific importance for fetal and infant development, and also advocacy importance as a motivating factor to get the public involved. So, for example, this first environmental health scientist says it's very important scientifically because babies are developing, and so breast milk exposures have the potential to have effects beyond the effects on adults. And this person goes on, from an advocacy point of view, it's just heartbreaking to think that you're downloading your exposure to your child. We looked at whether respondents described taking personal or professional action in their own lives as a result of biomonitoring data. And it's important to note, only three of our respondents had been personally biomonitored, so the majority of people are speaking about a hypothetical body burden that they likely carry, although they do not know what their own personal body burden is. So many respondents, especially those in the advocacy world in some capacity, assumed that biomonitoring motivates personal action. One organizer told me that biomonitoring data, quote, galvanizes people to want to take steps both to protect themselves and their families, or maybe get involved in policy issues and debates. In our interviews, we found that many, but not all, of our respondents reported taking personal action. So 17 people told us that they had changed personal behavior in some way. Only two mentioned taking specific personal actions related to flame retardants, although the interviews were primarily focused on flame retardants as a specific type of chemical. So one epidemiologist said that after reading a specific article on flame retardants, she threw away her child's pillow. I have no idea if the memory foam pillow had any PBDEs in it, but you know, I'm not taking the chance with that. But most of the people who described taking personal action in their own lives were talking about other types of chemicals. They were talking about organic food, personal care products, or BPA-free containers, not flame retardants. And three respondents told us that they were so aware of their body burden, or their hypothetical body burden, and so aware of the links between their personal behaviors and that body burden that they were desensitized because they, quote, had become hyper aware of what I do. However, 14 respondents told us that they had taken no action in their personal lives related to reducing their own body burden. And we saw four variations to this response. The first, several people told us that they were not worried because they were not a young woman of childbearing age. So this public health scientist said, if I were young and female and interested in having a kid, it would be very different. Several also told us that because of their own personal knowledge of science, that science told them that this wasn't an issue they needed to be concerned about. We particularly saw this in respondents who worked in industry in some capacity. So this one industry representative said, it's not something that concerns me, maybe because I understand the science behind that, behind biomonitoring. Third, they emphasized that this is not something that can be fixed through personal consumption, and so they preferred to prioritize regulatory changes. So I really think that at least for PBDEs, the idea of trying to limit your exposure, I'm not sure there's much I can do, said one exposure scientist. And finally, several didn't want to worry about their own exposure levels, and we particularly saw this for individuals who had some sort of historical exposure or personal history. So this person is talking about their mother growing up in Florida and the DDT spraying, and because of that, this individual doesn't want to think about their own body burden. Next, we'll examine how they talked about using biomonitoring research in their professional lives. And so we'll distinguish between regulators, scientists, activists, and people in industry. So regulators said that they used biomonitoring to identify policy priorities. For example, this regulatory scientist said that biomonitoring of PBDEs revealed that exposure was ubiquitous, and that it varied greatly through the population, leaving some individuals, and presumably millions of women of childbearing age, with very high levels of exposure. And that, in and of itself, made this a policy priority that they wanted to pursue in their own career. Scientists talked about using biomonitoring data in several ways. First, multiple scientists said that the early Swedish biomonitoring studies that I mentioned at the beginning of the talk had directly inspired their work or the work of their colleagues. And you can see this influence in this chart of PubMed articles on PBDEs, where you see an exponential increase following the 1999 conference presentations and 2000 publications of this data. And we thank Mike McLean and his colleagues at the BU School of Public Health for this wonderful slide. Scientists also described three additional ways in which biomonitoring influenced their own research. First, some told us that they chose biomonitoring as a method because it's easier to understand and quicker, and can be conducted more quickly than epidemiological work. Second, biomonitoring science allows scientists to raise awareness. So this public health scientist said, we want to do biomonitoring because if we can show that it's actually coming out of people and we'll be able to mention it in children, then it will get attention. And they used biomonitoring data to identify future research topics or to, quote, pick up new hazards. Activists also talked about using biomonitoring data in their work, and they argued that it was a compelling and useful tool for raising awareness and lobbying for environmental reform. They said it gave them inspiration to continue engaging in environmental organizing by highlighting how important this issue is for their lives and the lives of the people they work with. It also helps them to lobby legislators. This organizer said, the most provocative thing for legislators is to hear are the stories of their constituents getting sick or worrying about their kids getting sick. Third, they believed that biomonitoring highlighted regulatory failures or, quote, points out a flaw in the system. And activists also said that it helps them get press coverage and raise awareness about the issue. Finally, industry representatives spoke differently about about using biomonitoring in their own work. First, they emphasized that levels are too low to be of concern. This industry representative said, I mean, you can look at something, you go, well, is that a bad level? Now, I have a science background, so I can see parts per trillion. I know what that means. It means there ain't much there. Second, industry representatives emphasized that it is difficult to communicate the costs and benefits of chemicals because people get nervous when they learn they're carrying a body burden. The question is, this industry representative said, how do you take that information and make good decisions? And they emphasized that we should not be regulating just on biomonitoring data alone. this industry consultant said, it's just one piece. I mean, you can't start restricting hundreds of chemicals just because they appear in the human body. Finally, respondents talked about the challenges of working with biomonitoring data. And we identified four types of challenges that they brought up in interviews. First, exposure scientists emphasized that it was a challenge for them because they were unable to link an individual's body burden with a certain exposure when you're dealing with a ubiquitous chemical like PBDE, flame retardants. It's in just about everything, this exposure scientist said. It's in your home, it could be work, it could be your car, it could be all that. They also emphasized that it's difficult for them to link an exposure to a certain health outcome. This organizer said, you get a level of a particular chemical, that doesn't tell you anything about the biological impacts of that exposure. Respondents also emphasized that flame retardant exposure is ubiquitous and unavoidable, and there's a lot of uncertainty about what we're exposed to or where our personal exposures might be coming from. And finally, they emphasize the issue of replacement chemicals. So as PBDE and other flame retardants are phased out of the market, new flame retardants rise to fill that market niche. And this exposure scientist said, there's going to be new products coming on board. Those new products are going to need attention too, because they're going to completely replace PBDEs and be used in huge amounts. So to conclude, interviews with respondents who worked on flame retardant chemicals in some way revealed that biomonitoring research is central to the work that they're doing, and not just central to exposure scientists actually conducting biomonitoring projects. Biomonitoring data has been influential in moving policymakers to ban certain categories of flame retardants, and is also viewed as an extremely useful tool for organizers and activists. The centrality of biomonitoring is likely to grow as laboratory methods advance and as people become more aware of the everyday exposures that they face. Additionally, our research highlights the importance of advocacy biomonitoring projects and how those projects are increasingly connected both to government and academic research. Academics and regulators noted that advocacy biomonitoring could be useful for many purposes, and activists relied on those larger, more statistically powerful biomonitoring studies like the NHANES research to strengthen their activist campaigns. However, as industry quotes indicate, and as the literature on chemical regulation efforts shows, biomonitoring data's ability to move or change regulatory science and regulatory decision making remains to be seen, and this is certainly an important topic for future research. So thank you very much.
We have a few minutes for questions if folks have questions.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, in terms of like health education, whether you've seen whether people feel more empowered about this information or more hopeless, and especially when you connect it to people's ability to access healthier choices, whether it's organic food or even acknowledging whether there's a flame retardant.
That's a great question. I think that overall respondents felt that knowledge is empowering and it's important for people to have as much information about these chemicals as possible, even when in the case of flame retardants, most products that contain flame retardants will contain a brominated or chlorinated flame retardant. There are a few alternatives on the market that we know are safer. And so even in this case where you can have information and you still may not be able to take many direct changes in their lives, people felt that information was empowering. Most people, at least. There were those three people who felt very disturbed and sort of like they had to be on hyper alert all the time. And for that small subset, the extra information might not be helpful. But for the majority, more information was better.
Any other questions?
Are you planning to have kind of talks with actually firefighters or workers?
Definitely. I've spoken to several firefighters and plan to reach out more to the firefighting community and also to the fire safety and fire, like there are a number of fire standard development organizations, and so I definitely plan to speak to those people. And one thing that I think is so interesting about the flame retardant story is that it is this example of a blue-green alliance between many of these environmental organizations and this very unique occupationally exposed group. So it's an important part of the story.
Mm-hmm. Does NIOSH or OSHA have a position on exposures of the firefighters?
Not that I know of. The International Association of Firefighters has taken a stance, but I'm not sure if NIOSH or has. That's a great question. Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.